Welcome to the Campbell Conversations. I'm Grant Reher. Most of the talk these days about the United States and Asia is focused on China and North Korea. But India is an extremely important nation in the region as well, and my guest today can certainly speak to that. Sandeep Chakravorty is the Consul General of India, posted in New York City. He's held a number of prior posts in the Indian Foreign Service, including Ambassador to Peru and Bolivia. Consul General Chakravorty, welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be on this channel.
So let's start with a look back. India is today seen extremely favorably by Americans. There was a recent survey that found that India ranked sixth in terms of Americans' favorability ratings of other countries. But it wasn't always that way, especially in the Cold War. So tell me a bit about that background history of India-U.S. relations.
Well, I think you're very right when you say that. And it has never been like this, or it wasn't like this before. Although we had abundance of goodwill in the U.S. During our colonial times, it was, the conversations between Roosevelt and Churchill were famous, where Roosevelt was pressurizing Great Britain to give independence to the colonies, and that meant basically India. But and we established our diplomatic presence here in 1941, which was 6 years before we became independent. But right after we became independent, the Cold War politics started. And because of many reasons, including geography and geopolitics, India was not on the side the U.S. would have preferred. And India espoused a policy of non-alignment, which was not seen very favorably by the U.S. And for various reasons, the preferred partner in South Asia for the U.S. was Pakistan, our neighbor with whom we had a major dispute. And things kept on. I would not say it was a deep and a very abrupt kind of cut in our relations, but things, there were good things to, good sides to our relationship. You know, the U.S. supported us on many things, including on our China war in 1962. But there was never any real bonhomie between the two countries because of Cold War politics. And things deteriorated a lot during the 1971 Bangladesh war, where we felt that, you know, the right cause was against genocide in Bangladesh and the U.S. was supporting Pakistan. So that was a low point in our relationship. And then in 1974, when we had our first peaceful nuclear explosions, U.S. didn't take kindly to that and imposed a lot of barriers to our access to high technology. So practically during the Cold War, you know, we were not on the same side. And then the Soviet intervention in Afghanistan, we were against the Taliban, and the U.S. thought it could do business with Taliban. So again, there were complications. Things started to look up only after the dissolution of the Soviet Union in the late 80s and early 90s. And in 1991, when we opened our market, you know, we were a socialist economy. In 1991, we went for market reforms. Since then, our relations have started to look up, but I think the major upturn in our relationships happened only after 1998, when we had a second round of nuclear tests. And then U.S. really noticed India, and our market reforms were gathering steam. And from 2000 onwards, after Bill Clinton's visit to India in March of 2000, I think the last 18 years have been very productive.
And I was wondering about what the turning point was, if there was a turning point. Was it Bill Clinton's visit then that really, if you had to identify a moment where there was a pivot? I've read elsewhere that George W. Bush was regarded as a very pro-India U.S. president.
I believe the pivot was the second nuclear explosions in 1998 when U.S. imposed sanctions on us. But we started a process of dialogue with the United States known as the Strobe-Talbot-Jaswant Singh dialogue. Those were very long-drawn dialogue on with everything on the table on various issues, not only non-proliferation and security issues, but also, I think, other cooperation issues. So that was 1998 onwards. And then in 1999, in the Kargil War with Pakistan, U.S. came out on our side. That was the first time we saw that U.S. was being, you know, honest from in the Indian perspective, and the U.S. Supported us and asked Pakistan to withdraw its forces who had penetrated into our territory. And then that led to the visit by Bill Clinton. And in the mid-2000s, George Bush stewarded the relationship. We had the India-US nuclear deal. And I think since then, we have not looked back. So after Bill Clinton, it is both on the American side and on our side, Prime Minister Manmohan Singh, and of late, last 4 years, Prime Minister Modi. On that side, President Bush, President Obama, and now President Trump, they've all been very supportive of this relationship.
But that you've described, though, in terms of the history, a lot of rifts, you know, and a lot of what sound like pretty deep conflicts. And so what do you think is driving the good relationship at its base? Is it shared economic interests? What do you think is really kind of driving this change?
You see, in 1994, a U.S. diplomat known as Ambassador Dennis Cox, he wrote a book called Estranged Democracies.
Hmm.
So when you use the word estranged, you know, you presuppose a relationship. You know, there is affection. You know, you're talking of spouses.
Right.
So I think there is a bedrock of commonality of our shared values of democracy. And India never posed any threat to the United States. You know, there was lack of interest in India because of the Cold War dynamics, and also because maybe India was not economically significant for the United States. But in the last two or three decades, the Cold War disappeared. The old Cold War disappeared. I'm not talking for maybe what you may describe as the new Cold War. Mm-hmm. But that disappeared. And India became economically resurgent. India started rising. Our growth rate reached almost 10%. There were more opportunities, more business. And another factor was the growing Indian diaspora in the United States. Mm-hmm. They have also contributed a lot and given ballast to the relationship.
I'm Grant Reher, and I'm speaking with Sandeep Chakravorty, Consul General of India in New York City. So thinking about the present day now and even looking into the future, why is India so important to the United States? I mean, I can think of different sort of areas in which it may be important, but I was curious to hear you tell me, why do you think India will be important to the United States now and into the future?
You see, I will give a few reasons to explain my point. One is, of course, people may not recognize it, but I think because we are democracies, I think there is a great deal of understanding. You know, there are certain things which we will not do to each other or to ourselves. You know, there is deep respect for the rule of law. And I think that cuts a lot of ice on both sides. You know, people, end of the day, I think it's more you're more comfortable dealing with democracies. And if you look into Asia, you know, apart from India, there aren't too many examples to look up to. And we also value the American system, the American democracy, respect for rule of law. That is one. Secondly, the Indian economy is growing. India is the fastest growing economy in the world. You know, we clocked 8.25% in the last quarter. And this growth will be sustained. You know, there are a lot of projections which say that this growth rate will remain. It will not decline.
Hmm.
And we will be in the next 4 or 5 years the third largest economy in the world. After USA, China, then it will be India. So you have to deal with India. The growth in the world will come from India. The jobs in the world will come from India. Innovation will come from India. India is going to become digital. You know, there's a massive digital revolution going on in India. So the future of India is digital. So where will the U.S. companies and the U.S. Jobs come and arise from? India is a huge market. So that will come from India. So, you know, it's not only values, it's also economic interest. And we are a force of stability in Asia. You know, we are not in conflict. We don't export terror. We are working together on terror. Another turning point, if you allow me to just
sure,
roll
absolutely.
Back a bit, was 9/11 when, you know, it created a special bond between India and the U.S. Because earlier when we used to talk of transnational terror, there were not too many takers until the tragedy of 9/11 happened. Then we realized that terror knows no boundaries. And I think there is a great deal of counterterrorism cooperation between the two countries. So from the security angle, from the geopolitics, I think U.S. sees India as a valued partner. And we believe in this relationship.
Well, let me turn it around. What about thinking about India's future and how the United States factors into that? What's the importance there?
You see, India's growth was a bit stifled by the technology denial regimes that were put in place. And, you know, since we signed the nuclear accord, Technology denial has stopped, and, you know, we are now a preferred technology partner. U.S. has made us a major defense partner. Then we have got something called the Trade Strategic Authorization Tier 1. So we are the only non-ally or non-NATO member country to get that authorization. Mm-hmm. That shows India is a responsible partner. So India's future is in technology. And I think we have the brain power. We, you know, most of the technological companies here, in fact, in the U.S. even, are run by Indians. So I think if you look for technology, you know, there is a great deal of synergy between India and the United States. So we look forward to U.S. for technology, for tie-ups, for market, you know, for opportunities for our people. So I think on every sphere of human enterprise, I find an India-U.S. connect.
Now, you mentioned when you were talking about the size of the economies and India will become the third largest, China being the second. I wanted to ask you a question about China. How does China factor into the future relationship between the U.S. and India as you see it? India is some kind of buffer, or is it more complicated than that?
I believe it's more complicated than that. From the U.S. perspective, I think I found a lot of analysts and observers talking or saying what you just said. But I think we don't want to enter into that kind of an equation between the United States and China. You know, we want to have our own equation with the U.S. and we want to have our own equation with China. You have to understand that we don't have the luxury of distance with China. China is on our head. We have 2,200 miles of frontier with China. We have the largest disputed frontier in the world so far with China. So we have historical relations with China. China is a reality in our neighborhood. We have had issues with China. We had fought a war with China. The U.S. has never fought a war with China. So the way we look at China is different. You know, we have to manage this relationship. We know how to manage this relationship, and we cannot enter into an adversarial position with China, because, you know, our priorities are different. Our priorities is domestic transformation of the country, and we want to maintain cordial relations with every country in the world. So we believe that U.S. is a natural ally, but we also don't want to convert China into an adversary. That luxury we don't have.
You're listening to The Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. I'm Grant Reher, and I'm talking with Sandeep Chakravorty, Consul General of India in New York City, and we've been discussing India and the United States. I had a question for you now, Consul General, about how people in India, and if it's possible to generalize, but how people in India tend to view America and Americans. I'm thinking about how the citizens view this country. How do they think about it as a country, and how do they view Americans as a people?
I think it's a very good question. You said that there was a survey in the U.S. where India was ranked sixth.
Sixth, right.
I think if you do that survey in India, America will be ranked number one.
Ah.
I think there is a great deal of goodwill towards America. President Trump is very popular in India. There are even temples dedicated to the President of the United States in India. And I'm not joking. You can look it up on the net. So great deal of positivity is there. There is, of course, you know, our Prime Minister spoke at in the U.S. Congress, at the joint session of the Congress in 2006. And he said that both the countries have overcome the hesitations of the past. You know, we do the maximum number of military exercises with the United States. And last month, on September 6th, the two secretaries, Secretary of State and Secretary of Defense, went together to India and held bilateral meetings with their counterparts. And they signed something called COMCASA. It's a communication security agreement where United States and India will share defense communication equipment, codes, and intelligence. Now, that you do with a trusted partner. Mm. You don't do it with anybody else. I think that shows the level of confidence and trust that both the countries are developing. It is work in progress. We are working on many dimensions, but I think it has to be more textured. It has to. We have to connect at various levels. You know, 207,000 Indian students study here. That's another aspect of our relationship. More and more American universities are sending their students to intern or to study in India. Numbers are small yet. I think it was 5,000 last year. But many universities in the United States are having India Study Center or South Asian Centers. South Asian Centers are actually code for India centers, because most of the work they do is on India. And a lot of connect is happening in the education field, in the science and technology field, company to company. Indian companies are investing in the United States. Our companies are creating jobs. These things didn't happen 10 years or 15 years back. We are buying defense equipment from the United States. Earlier, in the U.S. defense equipment was not available to us. There's a talk of fabricating the F-series aircraft in India. So amazing, frontiers are being touched. And I think I don't see anything holding us back. I think only our creativity and our capacities will hold us back.
You mentioned in that that President Trump is seen favorably. I think you said that. Is there any controversy in India about how the president is viewed? I mean, as you know, of course, there's enormous controversy here in this country about how he's viewed. So tell me a little bit more about how Indians see President Trump.
No, we see any foreign leader with eyes of how he deals with our country. You know, we will not look into domestic politics of that country, you see. So as far as President Trump is concerned, he has, and his administration, you know, they have really spoken very well of India, and President Trump has said very nice things about India, and they have followed up on action on the ground. You know, India was declared as a major defense partner. Then we got something called exemptions on the Russia deal and many other things, you know, technology sharing, companies investing. You know, Walmart bought an Indian company for $20 billion. So it's a huge investment. We are buying LNG and oil from the United States. We have a huge order book of aircraft from the United States. So, you know, where the things matter, things are happening. You know, so people see that, you know, we are creating jobs here. Americans are creating jobs in India. There is a lot of, you know, we have so many direct flights from the United States to India and vice versa. So in every sphere of human activity, we find a U.S. connect. I think that is what the people appreciate. And as I mentioned before, this diaspora, you know, they are the glue, they are the bond between the two countries. And the Indian diaspora is well-to-do, very affluent. They're in good positions. They're in universities, in good jobs, heading corporations. Some of them are in the Congress. So they also help in this bonding between the two countries.
If you've just joined us, you're listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. And my guest is the Consul General of India in New York City, Sandeep Chakravorty. So let me ask you now about the future of India from the standpoint of challenges. What do you think are the biggest challenges that India is going through now and that it's going to go through in the near future?
I think our challenges are domestic. India is a huge country. It's a diverse country. It's a multi-ethnic, multi-religious country. So our challenge is maintaining internal order, jobs for our people. India is the youngest country in the world. 70% of our population is below the age of 35. So every month we have to create at least 1 or 2 million jobs. So I think our challenges are there, education, health. So if we can meet our domestic challenges, I think the external challenges are cakewalk for us, you know, if I'm using the word rightly.
I think you are.
So I think our challenges are internal, and I think we are aware of that, and we're working on that. A lot of transformation of India is happening, whether it is our infrastructure, our railways, our roads, and the digital world. We believe our future is digital. And, you know, we are moving from payments, digital payments, to services on the mobile phone. India has the largest mobile phone network in the world. You know, 1.2 billion mobile phone connections are there. And our future is there.
And shifting the topic a little bit, but as the Consul General for India and the United States in New York City, I understand that you've been very keen to try to streamline the visa and the passport services for Indian citizens. Coming back to Trump again, has the Trump administration's changes in immigration policy had any kind of impact on that at all? Has there been any effect?
There has been some effect, particularly because we believe that our skilled workforce has contributed immensely to the United States, particularly in the IT sector. And, you know, if you see the major IT corporations, whether it's Google or Microsoft, they're all headed by Indians. You know, you go to Silicon Valley or you go to New York or Boston, you know, the technology jobs are held, many of them are held by Indians. I think we have contributed enormously to this digital revolution that the world has witnessed and America has witnessed, and from which America is taking profit, you know, all these Apples and all, Google and all, they are, you know, our sweat and blood has gone into that. So we believe that it is important for these companies to prosper. You need this flow of brain power, you know, and brain power, God has been kind in distributing brain power quite equitably, if not riches, you know, and natural resources. He has divided brain power quite equitably. So we are 1.2 billion people. Now, you know, you are entering into the world of artificial intelligence. Some people say there are only 10,000 programmers who can do artificial intelligence. So by statistics, we will have the most in India. You know, we are the largest population in the world. So I think, you know, free flow of human capital is very important. And U.S. has benefited from that. So we in our conversations with the U.S. government, we talk about that, that, you know, we need to allow that. Otherwise, it will stifle the growth in these sectors.
And you yourself have a background in the environment. And I understand that you've spoken out about environmental issues, including global warming. And I think one of the difficult problems in thinking about confronting this on a global scale is the tensions that exist between the developed and then the still growing and still developing nations, with essentially the developed nations asking those other nations to deny themselves some of the things that the developed nations have already tapped and benefited from. So there's kind of an asymmetry in the dialogue there, it seems to me. How do you think that tension can get worked out?
Grant, I agree with you, but I think we have been able to work that out by agreeing to the Paris Accord, when we signed on the Paris Accord. There was this tension prior to that where we talked of, you know, differentiated responsibility. But I think we also believe that climate change will hurt us. It is, if it's not already hurting us. And we believe that we have to grow, but we have to grow responsibly. So while we will not like any limits to our growth, we are adopting a lot of climate-friendly policies. For instance, I'll give you a small example. Our renewable energy program, whether it's solar or wind, is one of the largest of the world. And, you know, we are working towards a very, very healthy mix in our energy basket. So we see a future where our fossil fuel dependence will reduce. Our power that we will generate from solar or wind or other renewable sources will be a major part of our energy basket. So we have dedicated resources for that. So while we will keep on growing and we will need to rely on some of the fossil fuel, the mix is very healthy. Our energy intensity is reducing. So we know that, you know, nobody else will come and fix it for us. We have to fix it ourselves. So I think we are conscious of that, and we have signed on to the Paris Accord.
And I also understand that you are a particularly strong supporter of the arts and culture and cultural exchanges, and you've sponsored some of those things in different ways in your positions. Tell me if you could, and we've got a few minutes left. I might try to squeeze in another question after this, but tell me how you see the importance of arts and culture fitting into the broader issue of international relations. What's the connection there?
You see, I'm a firm believer in soft power, you know, cultural diplomacy, because I think end of the day, when you eat other countries or other person's cuisine, or you dress like him, or you sing his songs, then you are really influenced. You know, that is the real power, you know. Under coercion, you may be forced to do anything. So I believe, for instance, you know, I believe that our soft power is very effective in the United States. And the best example is yoga, you know. If you tell somebody yoga is from India, they are bewildered. They believe it's an American invention, you see. So I think that makes me feel very happy, you know. If the Americans believe that yoga is American, I feel I'm the happiest person on earth. Then also cuisine, our music, Bollywood. So I think, you know, end of the day, this is the real connect, you know. It's not money, it's not power, it's not weapons. When you start behaving and talking other person's language, when you listen to his music or you dance according to her tune, then you are really influenced. And I think that's the future of mankind and hope for mankind.
You anticipated my very last question. We've got a couple minutes left, but I also understand that you mentioned yoga, a very deep practitioner of it, and and believe very strongly in its benefits. And I think even when you were ambassador to Peru and Bolivia, you did a sunrise yoga exercise at Machu Picchu.
Yes, I think that well known very well. Yes.
So tell me a little bit more about how you understand yoga and how it fits into your life and the way that you find balance and all the different benefits that you've taken from it.
Well, you see, there are two aspects of yoga. One is the asanas, or the physical exercises. And the other part is self-control, you know, where how you control your mind and how you derive peace from within yourself. Because a yogi believes that, you know, the God is within you. Your happiness and your pleasure or joy is within you in how you control yourself. You know, nobody can make you angry if you don't want to be angry, or nobody can hurt you if you don't want to feel hurt. So I think I go by that aspect. You know, I try to internalize the problem and try to solve it within me. And I also believe that, you know, end of the day, our problems will be solved. Even climate change problems will be solved if all of us behave responsibly. You know, if we reduce our consumption, if you hurt our environment less, our Mother Nature less, I think that is the only solution for climate change. So that way, I think it's a yogic solution. You know, yoga also says, you know, one of our great yogis was Swami Vivekananda, who was the first person to talk of, you know, self, how the self can make change in this world. You know, it's not that, you know, others will do it for you. You have to do it for yourself. I think that is the aspect of yoga which appeals the most to me. I am not very physically well endowed, and I cannot practice the very convoluted asana, some of them, but I take a lot of merit in this aspect, in the soft aspect of yoga.
It sounds like something that maybe we ought to mandate that all Congress does. Everybody in Congress does yoga. That was Indian Consul General Sandeep Chakravorty. Consul General Chakravorty, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me.
Thank you, Grant. It's a pleasure to be on your channel.
You've been listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO, Conversations in the Public Interest.
The Campbell Conversations, Conversations in the Public Interest, was hosted and produced by Grant Reher, engineered by Tom Fazio, and edited by Jason Smith. Campbell Conversations is a joint production of the Campbell Public Affairs Institute at Syracuse University and WRVO Public Media. To learn more about the program or to hear previous interviews, visit wrvo.org/Campbell Conversations.